Lord Brahma is the first demigod, and Hiran Yaksha is the first demon in this universe. Only under certain conditions do the planets float as weightless balls in the air. And as soon as these conditions are disturbed, the planets may fall down in the Garbhagak Ocean, which covers half the universe. The other half is the spherical dome within which the innumerable planetary systems exist. The floating of the planets in the weightless air is due to the inner constitution of the globes and the modernized drilling of the earth to exploit oil from within is a sort of disturbance by the modern demons and can result in a greatly harmful reaction to the floating condition of the earth. A similar disturbance was created formerly by the demons headed by Hiranyaksha, the great exploiter of the gold rush, and the earth was detached from its weightless condition and fell down into the Garbhagak Ocean. The Lord, as maintainer of the whole creation of the material world, therefore assumed the gigantic form of a boar with a proportionate snout and picked up the earth from within the water of Garbhagak. Sri Jayadeva Goswami, the great Vaishnava poet, sang as follows. Vasati dashana sikare dharani tadalakna shashini kalanta kalevam himagna keshavadrita shukara rupa jaya jagadisha hare. And so on. O Keshava, O Supreme Lord, who have assumed the form of a boar, O Lord, the planet Earth rested on your tusks, and it appeared like the moon engraved with spots. Such is the symptom of an incarnation of the Lord. The incarnation of the Lord is not the concocted idea of fanciful men who create an incarnation out of imagination. The incarnation of the Lord appears under certain extraordinary circumstances, like the above-mentioned occasion. And the incarnation performs a task which is not even imaginable by the tiny brain of mankind. The modern creators of the many chief incarnations may take note of the factual incarnation of God as the gigantic boar with a suitable snout to carry the planet Earth. When the Lord appeared to pick up the Earth, the demon of the name Hiranyaksha tried to create a disturbance in the methodical functions of the Lord, and therefore he was killed by being pierced by the Lord's tusk. According to Srila Jiva Goswami, the demon Hiranyaksha was killed by the hand of the Lord. Therefore his version is that after being killed by the hand of the Lord, the demon was pierced by the tusk. Srila Vishvanath Chakravarti Thakur confirms this version. Omanyana timaram nasya jananjana shalakaya chakshuru militam yena tasma shri gurave namaha. Shri Chaitanya Manodhistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Upakaramayam Dadakti Svapadam Sikam. Translation. Lord Brahma said, when the unlimitedly powerful Lord assumed the form of a boar as a pastime, just to lift the planet Earth, which was drowned in the great ocean of the universe called the Garbhagak, the first demon, Hiranyaksha, appeared, and the Lord pierced him with his tusk. So this is a summary description of the incarnation of Lord Varaha. So Srila Prabhupada has pointed out in other purports that there are two incarnations of Lord Varaha, the red incarnation and the white incarnation, Sveta Varaha. Srila Prabhupada pointed out that in some of the descriptions in the Bhagavatam, the two incarnations appear to be amalgamated together. In any case, in one of these two incarnations, Hiranyaksha, who is mentioned here, was engaging in these activities of apparently exploiting the earth for gold, and the earth had fallen down into the Garbhagak Ocean. And so Lord Varaha appeared to lift the earth from the Garbhagak Ocean. In the other incarnation of Lord Varaha, the Sveta Varaha incarnation, this incarnation occurred in the beginning of this day of Brahma. At that time, the earth was beneath the Garbhagak Ocean. That was the situation which had prevailed during the night of Lord Brahma. So when Swayambhuva Manu was manifested from Lord Brahma, Swayam Bhuvamanu, of course, knew that his duty was to generate population and govern the population of the universe that was thus generated. But in order to do this, the earthly planetary system was required. So he spoke to his father, Lord Brahma, and pointed out that the earth was beneath the waters of devastation. So Lord Brahma reflected then on how the earth could be raised up, and it's described that Lord Varaha appeared at this point. Apparently Lord Varaha emerged from the nose of Brahma in a very tiny form, and flying through space, he expanded until he had assumed a gigantic form, which was praised by the various great sages who were witnessing these events in the higher planetary systems. Lord Varaha then entered into the Garbhodak Ocean and lifted up the earth. So that is the other incarnation of Lord Varaha. So the basic setting of the in which these events take place is that you have the universe, which is described as a hollow area within a series of shells. Within this hollow area, half of the volume is filled with the water of the Garbhodak Ocean, and the other half consists of various planetary systems occupying empty space. So, in the case of the Svetavaraha incarnation, the earth was underneath the ocean waters. As I mentioned, this was the situation during the night of Brahma. So it's described that at the end of the day of Brahma, there's a pralaya in which the, first of all, the earthly planetary system is annihilated by fire. It's described that the sun becomes 12 times as hot as it normally is. After that time, there's an inundation by water produced by clouds. And the entire earthly planetary system is inundated. In fact, the description is that the planetary systems up to Swarga Loka are completely devastated during this pralaya. And it's even described that in Mahar Loka, which is the next planetary system up, the great sages depart for higher planetary systems in Vimanas due to the heat of the annihilation which is taking place below them. So you have this cosmological picture in which there are lower and higher planetary systems. So the Earth is considered to be the middle planetary system, and above that there are various higher systems. So the Earth and the systems up to Svarga Loka are annihilated during the pralaya. However, the Earth continues to exist, but it's under the water, and Lord Varaha lifts it up from the waters. Now, one might ask, what is this earth which is lifted up? The answer turns out to be that this is the entire Bhumandala. Thus, what is lifted is not just the earth globe, as we understand it, but it is basically it is described in the Bhagavatam as a disc-shaped region, which is about 4 billion miles in diameter. This is the same as the diameter of the inner hollow of the universe. Now, I said approximately 4 billion miles in diameter. In the Bhagavatam, there are verses saying that the diameter of Bhumandala is, in fact, 4 billion miles. Or in the units used in the Bhagavatam, the figure given is 500 koti of yojanas. Koti is 10 million. So 510 millions of yojanas would be the diameter of the earth. However, there's a commentary, which I believe is by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, which is cited by Srila Prabhupada in the fifth canto, but not translated. He just places the Sanskrit there. But a number of devotees have translated this over the years, and it gives a description of how to calculate the diameter of Bhumandala by adding up the diameters of various ring-shaped oceans and dvipas and so on and so forth. And it turns out that the diameter of Bhumandala is a little bit less than 4 billion miles. So there's a few hundred thousand miles gap between Bhumandala and the shell of the universe. So in that commentary, Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur explains that this makes it possible for the Earth to move down and sink into the Garbhodak Ocean. Because if it was of the same diameter as the shell, it would be rigidly fixed in one position. And he also said then that this made it possible for Lord Varaha to lift the Earth up from the ocean. He also pointed out that this situation provided Anantashesha with something to do in the matter of supporting the Earth. Because if it was rigidly fixed to the shell, there would be no need for Anantashesha to support it. This was the commentary that was given by Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur. So that is the Earth which Lord Varaha is lifting. So, let's see. What other observations are there on Lord Varaha? Well, another interesting observation. Of course, people will tend to say that this is, it's rather hard for one to understand how this story can be related to our present concepts of reality. So I should make a few observations about that. Of course, we have illustrations of Lord Varaha lifting the Earth as a globe, but it is definitely the entire Bhumandala which is lifted. This is also described in more detail in the Vishnu Purana. In the Vishnu Purana, it's pointed out that after Lord Varaha lifts the Earth from the waters, then he reestablishes the continents and so forth on the surface of the Earth. So the idea apparently is that the divisions of the continents were sort of blurred out when the Earth was under the water. So Lord Varaha reestablishes all those divisions. For example, the divisions between the different oceans and dvipas, and so forth. So, one can ask, how does this relate to the modern conception of the Earth as a globe? Srila Prabhupada makes an interesting point in this purport. He says that only under certain conditions do the planets float as weightless balls in the air. And as soon as these conditions are disturbed, the planets may fall down in the Garbhodak Ocean, which covers half the universe. There are several places in the Bhagavatam where Srila Prabhupada refers to Bhumandala as a system of globes floating in space, or as islands floating in the ocean of air. Now, the direct description which is given in the Bhagavatam is that Bhumandala is described as a disk, which is divided into different regions, such as the ring-shaped islands and oceans. But Srila Prabhupada does in several places refer to it as though it's a whole system of globes. So this seems to be an intermediary link between our idea of the Earth as one globe and the description of Bhumandala as a disk. So there's also this description which is given of a system of globes. So there's the question of how this can fall, how any of these globes could fall into the Garbhodak Ocean. If we are, let's see, I should first of all point out that even when the Earth is above the level of the Garbhodak Ocean, it is quite close to it relative to the other dimensions of the universe. Specifically, it is stated that Bhumandala is the middle planetary system. There are 7 lower planetary systems beneath Bhumandala. The gap between each of these pairs of systems as you go down is 10,000 yojanas. So that means you have a total of 70,000 yojanas to bring you to the bottom of the lower planetary systems. Then beneath that, there's another gap. I forget the figure for that right now, but it's not very large. And then you have the Garbhodak Ocean. So in comparison, if you look at the diameter of the Bhumandala of 4 billion miles, or it comes out to, I think what I said previously was wrong, because I said 500 koti yojanas. I should say 50 koti yojanas, because it's 500 million yojanas. Because then if you multiply that by 8, you get 4,000 million miles, or 4 billion. Those are the figures that are given. But that diameter for Bhumandala is very large compared to the distance between Bhumandala and the surface of the ocean. So that means if you were to make a model in which you had, let's say, a bowl filled with water representing the Garbhodak Ocean, then the planetary systems of Bhumandala and the seven lower systems would be like seven sheets of thin paper floating right on the surface of the water. That's how the proportions would work out. So that means the Earth is very close to that ocean. Now, logically speaking, you would think, also there's an interesting metaphor given in the Vishnu Purana when it describes this. And there it's described that when Lord Varaha made the Earth float upon the water, it was like placing a banana leaf on the surface of the water. So you can imagine a flat leaf floating on the water surface. So this leads to the question that if one is standing on something in which a plane extends out, and on one side of that plane you have water, and on the other side you have outer space, then you would think that looking into outer space, this plane should block your vision for half of the volume of space in your vicinity. However, the astronomers will say that we can see stars in outer space in all directions. In other words, here at night, if you're standing out here in one of these fields and you look at the sky, you see the stars overhead, and you can see stars over a total angle of 180 degrees. Because the Earth is blocking your vision. But the idea is the Earth being a globe, somebody standing at the antipodal point, that is the point just opposite you on the Earth, he's also looking at a 180 degree angle at different stars, but he's seeing the opposite 180 degrees to what you're seeing. And if you put together the two things that you're seeing, it adds up to a full 360-degree range of vision in which you see stars in outer space in all directions. So that point would be made concerning the Earth globe. So if that is so, then how can it be that half of the universe is filled with an ocean? So the basic point that I'm coming to then is that the descriptions in the Bhagavatam refer to a higher dimensional situation. Somehow or other, part of this flat surface on which we're located, in effect, is wrapped around so that you can go around and look out from it, and you have the impression that you're on a complete sphere, whereas it corresponds to a section of the surface of a plane. That's basically the way it's described. Interestingly enough, in the Surya Siddhanta, the Earth is described as a sphere. Now, in the description of Bhumandala as a plane, the lower planetary systems are planes situated beneath Bhumandala. But in the Surya Siddhanta, it's described that the lower planetary systems are regions inside the sphere of the Earth. So if you map a part of the plane to a sphere, then you map part of the lower systems into regions inside that sphere. So somehow the arrangement of our senses is such that in a very consistent way, we see a very small region of Earth which is cut off in the form of a sphere surrounded by space on all sides. But but that is part of a larger system. Srila Prabhupada explained this with an analogy in one conversation that took place in Vrindavan in 1977. Several devotees were asking him about the description in the fifth canto, and they were saying that, well, if Jamudvip and Bhumandala, which is extending beyond that, if this is a flat plane, then how do we have the experience of going around the earth, which we, many of us, have done in jet airplanes? And they were saying, well, suppose you start in London, and you go around to New Delhi, and then to Tokyo and Los Angeles and New York, and then you come back to London. So how does that work? And using the concept of the flat plane, Srila Prabhupada made the analogy that we're only seeing part of the earth. He said that just as a bull or an ox could be tied to a central pole for threshing grain, that ox is constrained by the yoke and different wooden bars and so forth, so that he can only go around in a circle. So in his experience, if you walk, you come around to where you started. And the ox, being not very intelligent, may be bewildered by this. And so he just goes around in a circle, and he thinks, well, that's the way things are, perhaps. I don't know what it's like to be an ox. He may be contemplating the whole thing philosophically and not letting on. But in any case, but the vast earth is around him, is there, but he has no access to it because he's constrained to move in a circle. So Srila Prabhupada said that similarly, we're constrained by the arrangement of Krishna to move within a certain spherical region of earth. And we don't actually see the entire earth. We only see a small part of it. He pointed out, for example, that we don't see the real Himalaya mountains, and that it would not be possible for an airplane to fly over the actual Himalayas. Of course, you can consider that the Bhagavatam says that the Himalayas are 10,000 yojanas high, which would come to 80,000 miles at 8 miles per yojana, which is 10 times the diameter of the Earth as we know it today, because the Earth as we know it is about 8,000 miles in diameter. So how can you have mountains then 80,000 miles high? But the point then is that what we experience is a small subdivision of something that is much larger. But that larger continuum, due to the arrangement of Krishna's energy, is basically what you could call higher dimensional. That is, it extends in a manner that we don't directly see. It's beyond our senses. This term higher dimensional is really synonymous with saying that it's beyond the range of our senses, because our senses are linked up with the energy of the material world in such a way that we see only certain things, but we don't see everything. So that example of the ox illustrates that point. The yoke constrains the senses of motion of the ox, his active senses, namely the legs, in such a way that he can only go in a circle. Whereas if the constraint wasn't there, then the ox could go in a straight line and travel a much greater distance. So similarly, our senses potentially could experience a much greater region of the earth, but because of constraints that are imposed, we experience a limited region. So that was the idea that indicated by that example. So, in this higher dimensional realm, in which you have Garbhodak Ocean and the larger Earth, the Bhumandala, within that realm, this pastime of Lord Varaha took place. And Lord Varaha was able to enter into the Garbhodak Ocean and lift up the Earth. Even there, you see a problem in understanding how he could do it. Because if the earth really does extend right out to the edge of the shell with a little gap, then how did Lord Varaha get down underneath in order to lift it up? It would seem it would block the entire space in which he could maneuver. But I don't think it was a problem for Lord Varaha. So those are a few observations. An interesting thing that I just ran across is that throughout the world, there is mythology relating to the idea that some higher being comes down from the upper regions of the heavens and lifts up the earth from an ocean. So there are stories like this all over the world. In fact, the author who was making these observations commented that the Indians of North America, Native Americans, all seem to share a basic cosmology in which you have an ocean. Above the ocean, there are sort of higher planetary systems in which some high authority is living, the Supreme Spirit, or however it may be described. And a great personality goes down from this higher region into the ocean and lifts up the earth. So he was making this comment about the Indians of North America. So that's interesting if you consider the story of Lord Varaha. Actually, a curious point is that these different stories in the Bhagavatam have parallels in old mythology all over the world. And one can ask how that came about. It's certainly suggestive of strong connections. Well, one can think of the connections as working in two possible ways. Either you have the idea that there was once a civilization that at least extended its influence all over the earth so that these stories could be carried to different parts of the earth by human beings. Or the other possibility is that you have direct connections from different parts of the earth with higher planetary systems. Either way, you have the idea of a larger system of civilization existing than is understood to exist according to modern historians and anthropologists. So you either have a celestial civilization interacting with all different parts of the earth, or you have a higher civilization here on the earth plus a celestial civilization. But certainly the evidence of these different so-called mythological stories is suggestive that the different societies on the surface of the earth did not just evolve independently in their own little local neighborhoods. So that's interesting from the point of view of the Vedic conception, according to which there was a global Vedic civilization in the past. And also, prior to Kali Yuga, there was extensive contact between the earth and higher planetary systems. So it's interesting that this story of Lord Varaha also fits into that picture. Many other items described in the cosmology of the Bhagavatam also are found all over the earth. For example, the idea of a central axis mountain, namely Mount Meru. Many different conceptions are found all over the earth in different societies. So I'll stop there, I guess. Any questions? Yeah, Merle Gautica?
Our senses constrain us like the ox is constrained by the yoke. So do we then assume then in the higher planets, even within the system of the earthly planets, that's on Swargaloka, they're constrained in different ways, and their senses can perceive other things. And then even further up, Mahalok and Tapalok, etc., that they also have a different vision of reality because their senses constrain them differently. Their senses maybe are made up of different energies or, anyway.
Well, I presume that it's something like that. Certainly the demigods in Swargaloka are also conditioned souls, so their senses are constrained in different ways. As a general principle, you can say that. We may not have details on exactly how their senses are able to function. It does appear that in higher planetary systems, there's a lot of communication between different systems. For example, in Svargaloka, it may be that Indra runs into trouble with the demons. They've acquired some power and are attacking the heavenly planets. And so Indra and other demigods will go up to Brahma Loka to petition Lord Brahma to intervene and save their situation. So it would appear that they have access even to Brahma Loka, at least as visitors, whereas we don't have access even to Svargaloka, but to speak of Brahma Loka. And our astronomers, using their gross instruments, cannot detect Svargaloka. All they see is empty space and radiating points that they call stars and that they theorized about.
That would be akin to
you mentioned about the wraparound plane. So this, we've heard this theory before in the description of the hollow earth. So is that evolved from some specific mythology or someone, of course there's supposedly some actual perception of this by some persons, but is there anything?
Oh, the hollow earth theory?
Right.
Well, yes, there are various hollow earth theories. One of them says that, well, you've probably seen that there's some holes at the polar regions, and you go just sort of over the edge, down on the inside, so that there's a world in there. So you could say that there is an analogy between the fifth canto cosmology and the hollow earth theories, in the sense that we do say that there are subterranean inhabited regions. And of course the Bhagavatam describes the earth as a plane and the lower planetary systems as planes beneath it. But the Suryasiddhanta describes the earth as a globe and the lower planetary systems as, well, it says they are located within the concave strata of the earth. That's the phrase used in the translation I have. So that makes it sound sort of like the hollow earth theory. So in a sense, you could say we're hollow earthers, in a sense. We refer to Bila Svarga, which means the heaven in a hole. It's a rather interesting phrase, because Bila means a hole or a subterranean region, and Svarga means heaven. So the idea is that within the earth there's a heaven, a very heavenly region. In fact, it's described that in many ways Bila Svarga is more opulent than Svargaloka of Indra. So, by the way, there are descriptions of similar things in other cultures. That's another whole topic, the idea of levels of underworlds, some of which are heavenly. You can find that popping up in many different cultures all over the world also. Yeah?
Sometimes when we try to convey the dimensions so that we can understand, you might do something like give the example of a sphere intersecting a plane, and you can understand that the intersection of the sphere and the plane is a circle. And then if there's black people living on that plane, then that's what they see. They don't see the sphere. So you're talking about a wraparound concept, and you make reference to different dimensions. Is there any kind of analogy that can help us better understand how this might be?
In terms of geometric analogies? Well, let's see. Have to see if I can think of something right off. But I do not have a good model myself as to how exactly you relate the sphere to the plane. But from a geometrical point of view, you'd have to do it in higher dimensions, not within just three dimensions. Because if you try to do it in just three dimensions, you can take part of the plane, bulge it up, and make a sphere out of it. But you're going to have a neck which connects with the plane. Now, some people have proposed this. I've even seen diagrams, and they claim that the neck is to be found down in Antarctica. And according to that, if you went to Antarctica you see what in effect would look like a gigantic column extending up into outer space, and that's the neck. But you don't see that in Antarctica, according to what we hear. I haven't been down there myself. In fact, I only take it on faith that there is such a place as Antarctica. But then I only take it as on faith that there's such a place as South Africa, too. Not having been there. So, but certainly that would be a rather awkward conception. But to relate the globe to the plane, one has to go into a higher dimensional geometry, but I can't give the details of how that would work right offhand. Yeah?
We've heard that in the forest of Namsha, and that was formed, it goes through the center of the earth. We've heard that also that Ravana went through to Brazil, and we've also heard that Radha Damodar Temple in Sevakunj is the center of the earth. Can you?
In the Bhagavatam, there is a description that Lord Brahma was visualizing the universe in terms of a wheel, and that the center was located in the forest of Naimisharanya, as I recall. Wheel, of course, is chakra. So perhaps that's what you're referring to there. Certainly, if you look at the disk of Bhumandala, that is shaped like a wheel, it's a disk, and the center is Jambudvip. Of course, the way it's described in the Bhagavatam, the physical center is the center of Mount Meru, whereas Naimisharanya is located in Bharatvarsha, so it'd be a bit off-center. So, I don't know how one reconciles that, but it is described in the Bhagavatam that Lord Brahma was visualizing the center as being in Naimisharanya. As far as the other points, including going down through to Brazil from there, I don't really know. One hears occasionally about tunnels that go to Brazil. Srila Prabhupada spoke of such things. You can find it in different places in Folio, for example.
I thought there was an expedition. Do you want to go?
An expedition?
Yeah,
there, yeah, that description, that was supposed to go from what
Pyrenees,
Puerto
Rico? From the Pyrenees to Puerto Rico.
The Pyrenees to Puerto Rico. It was
That's
supposed
how
to be,
all those Spanish people came to Puerto Rico.
Right.
And it was supposed to be glowing with green light on the inside. And the story was that somebody drove a car through it.
With enough gas.
They ran out of gas pump?
No, they had enough gas. They planned
They took a big tank. Well, no, I never did check that one out. So, but this idea of tunnels to Brazil is there. Yeah?
That Lord Brahma is a Leela incarnation. And you're mentioning Swami Bhumimani. Lord Chaitanya describes in the Chaitanya Charitamrita and instructions to Sanatana Goswami how there are 14 mandalas, and each day of Brahma there's 420 in a month and 5,040 in a year. And in one lifetime of Brahma there's 504,000 mandala incarnations. He says all of them are considered incarnations. Yet and still, in the description in the Bhagavatam, it is stated that during the reign of Swami Bhumimandu, the incarnation is Yagya, and there's different ones for each mandu. So there seems to be some confusion about whether the actual mandu is the incarnation or there's an incarnation during each mandvantara.
Who is the mandvantara incarnation? Yes, I haven't looked into that lately. A few years back, I remember that question came up. And I seem to recall that the indication was that a manvantara incarnation is not necessarily the same as the Manu, but that is an incarnation of Vishnu who corresponds to that Manu period. He's the manvantara incarnation for that Manu. That's what I recall, I think, was the conclusion from that discussion. So that would be the point then. According to that, Svayambhuva Manu is not the Manvantara incarnation, but he's the Manu. That's what I recall. Yeah?
This is kind of related. I was listening to a tape of Prabhupada, and he was talking about the theory of evolution. He was saying Darwin had made a lot of mistakes, but the theory of evolution is there, he said, and the Padma Purana, it is explained. So I haven't read the Padma Purana, but I'd like to know. He said first there were the aquatics, and then this, and then that. Are you familiar with that?
Well, sure, Prabhupada. Yeah, I've run across that reference. To my knowledge, Srila Prabhupada is taking the word evolution and applying that to the transmigration of the soul through different species. And he gives the sequence of transmigration of the soul as going from aquatics to plants to, krimi, which would mean reptiles and worms and so forth, to beasts, in other words, mammals, birds, uncivilized humans, and civilized humans. But that is, now, if you look at that as an evolutionary sequence of transformation of the bodies of those organisms, that sounds very similar to what the scientists are saying, or what Darwin would have proposed. Namely, that you start out with life in the ocean, then life crawls out on the land. The first life on the land would be plants, because until plants were there, nothing else could live on the land. So you have aquatics, then you have vegetation on the land, then you have, amphibians and reptiles, so that they would come next. Then mammals develop, and then, birds come before mammals. Well, no, that's not really true. Primitive mammals come before birds, according to their system. And then the more advanced mammals come after the birds. And then finally, at the very end, you have the evolution of man. So that's the scientist's sequence. So that seems to correspond to the order given in the Padma Purana. But if you look at that order in evolutionary terms, it refers to the transmigration of the soul through the different species, and the species are considered to be fixed. So there the idea is that it's like a person who, let us say, moves to different apartments. So he goes from one apartment to another. It's not that the apartments are changing from one to another. That would be the idea. I guess we should stop there. Well, where is Srila Prabhupada?